I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 15th of May. I think there are very few people in the whole world who could write the book that Michael Lewis has written, Flash Boys, A Wall Street Revolt. Michael writes early in the book that this whole thing started when he first heard the story of this Russian computer programmer who had worked for Goldman Sachs in the summer of 2009 after he quit his job. He was arrested by the FBI and charged by the U.S. government with stealing Goldman Sachs' computer code. Michael thought it strange that after the financial crisis in which Goldman had played such an important role, that the only Goldman Sachs employee who had been charged with any sort of crime was the employee who had taken something from Goldman Sachs. So he was wondering, what was the code? Why was it so important that when it was discovered, Goldman Sachs needed to call the FBI? Michael Lewis's book has been on the bestseller list for weeks now, as have many of his other books. He's the author of Liar's Poker, Moneyball, which became a big movie, The Blind Side, which became a big movie, and The Big Short. And this particular book, Flash Boys, is being made into a film. Michael has familiarity with Wall Street. He worked there when he was a young kid. You know, he was in his 20s and left when he was about 27 to become a writer. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I hope some of you have had a chance to read the book, and many of you will be very familiar with the workings of Wall Street, although for him to find this story is pretty amazing. We welcome phone calls all hour, and here's how you reach our conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Michael Lewis, hello. Thanks for being with us again.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Michael. I can't believe there could be very many people in this whole wide world, as I just said, who could have figured out this story, Michael. Oh, my gosh. You have to have some familiarity with Wall Street. I never in a million years would have known this happened.
Neither would I. It really was flukish that I bumped into it. And I bumped into it only because, as you said, this Russian computer program had been put in jail, with Goldman Sachs' help, attracted me to really a question. And it was, what on earth is high-frequency trading and why does it seem so valuable to Goldman Sachs? And it led me to the characters who are the spine of the book. It helped that I worked on Wall Street, I guess. What really helped is they saw Moneyball as a template for what they were doing, which was essentially kind of like attacking a bad system or a system that was screwed up in some way. And as a result of that, they were a little bit maybe more willing to talk to me than they might have been to another reporter. But once they opened up, I think a lot of people could have told the story. The story is so powerful.
Yeah, but the cast of characters you found to tell the story are quite unlikely and extremely interesting.
Well, that's nice of you to say. I thought so too. I tell you what I thought. You know what unified them, and these are a group of people, starting with a Canadian stock trader at the Royal Bank of Canada named Brad Katsuyama. But they're a group of now 40 people who are banded together trying to essentially reform Wall Street from within. And they come from banks and high-frequency trading firms and stock brokerage firms and are at this new stock exchange called IEX. But what interested me about the characters was that to a person, they had walked away from huge paychecks, which, you know, people do in the world to find meaningful work. I mean, you see people walking out of the financial system all the time, but usually they walk out of the financial system. And that they had done it and put themselves in a position where they would be basically unemployable in the financial system because everybody in the financial system is going to be angry at them for trying to reform it. I thought that was interesting. And that to me was sort of what fueled my passion for the story. It was like, why do some people, when they see that some market in Wall Street has gotten screwed up, why do most people figure out how they can make money from how it's screwed up? But some people say, let's see if we can fix it so it isn't screwed up. I thought that was the kind of like the center of the story.
There are some people who are trying to do the right thing, huh?
No question. And it told me – it sounds – it's funny because the headline of course, of the book is that, you know, the stock market's rigged. And it sounds like it's a polemic. And it isn't really a polemic. It really is a narrative. And I thought it was actually the first hopeful narrative that I sort of bumped into since the financial crisis, because it wasn't just people figuring out the system was screwed up. I mean, a lot of people can look at our financial system and say it's screwed up in this way or that way. It's kind of obvious. Mm-hmm. But they actually had a plan that was a plausible plan to fix it that didn't require the government or regulators or anything. It just required the markets to function. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Maybe this is the path forward, that we have disruptive Silicon Valley-style entrepreneurs creating businesses on Wall Street that bring down the big inefficient ones and replace them with sustainable efficient ones.
Mm-hmm. You tell us what's wrong with this scenario, and you outline this in the book. Here you are, an average investor. You're logging into your – this is not me because I don't do any of this stuff. But you log into your TD Ameritrade or your E-Trade or your Schwab account. You enter a ticker symbol of some stock, and you click on an icon. It says buy. So then you – click it on and you're supposed to buy it, but what you think you know what happens after that doesn't really happen. You say, trust me, if you did know, you would think twice before you pressed it. So what happens?
Well, so let me preface this by saying that I do occasionally buy and sell stocks. Mm-hmm. And it is absolutely true that life has never been better for the likes of me, and that human beings have been removed from the process. The market is completely automated. And brokerage costs have collapsed. So you're paying less to a broker to execute your trade. However, the system that has replaced it has got – it could be very fair, and it is not very fair. What happens is your order is executed by someone who is allowed by law to execute it at essentially an old price, a stale price, and you're being traded against by people who high frequency traders who've paid for the right to trade against your stock market order, who know the real price. They've got several millisecond advantage.
Wow.
They know if prices have moved, and so your order is. All stock market orders are systematically exposed to a trader in the marketplace who has advanced news of price movements. That's one thing that is problematic about the system. It's essentially you're like at a racetrack betting against betting on the horses, and some of the people, and you're betting against the other people at the racetrack, and some of those people actually know the result of the horse race. Mm. So you're at that disadvantage. But the bigger problem is that the market in the last decade or so has organized itself to maximize the number of collisions between the people who know and the people who don't, between high-frequency traders and investors, because stock brokers and stock exchanges all have to get a cut of what the high-frequency traders make. Mm-hmm. And the market, in organizing itself this way, has constructed a less stable environment than it could have. We get flash crashes. We get lots of mini flash crashes that people don't pay that much attention to, but they happen. We get outages at stock exchanges. We get initial public offerings of big corporations, big companies that go wrong. So we have a much less sort of trustworthy marketplace to serve as a foundation for our economy. And that's what people should be concerned about, mm-hmm. The instability caused by this system.
Now, if you are a high-frequency trader, am I getting this wrong? You've actually got a special kind of fiber optics. It's like having a really fast computer if you live in Japan, and if you live in Milwaukee, it's not quite as fast. But you've got something that's state-of-the-art. It's so fast that a lot of other people don't have it, so you have an advantage because your system, the technology is really, really good?
So you have several sources of advantage. One is you pay the both the public stock exchanges. There used to be just a couple of exchanges, the New York Stock Exchange, NASDAQ, and that was kind of it, right? Mm-hmm. That's changed. There are now 13 public U.S. stock exchanges, all in New Jersey, scattered around New Jersey. And there are 40-something so-called dark pools, which are essentially private stock exchanges run by the banks. So there are as many as, 50-something places where you could, say, buy or sell the stock of Apple Computer. Mm-hmm. So in these markets, the high-frequency traders pay for the right to locate their machines physically right next to the exchange machine where the trades are taking place.
Right.
So they pay for the faster access to the information of what's coming out of the machine, because speed is distance. I mean, it takes time for a signal to travel over space. So the narrower you can make the space between your trading machine and the stock market, the faster you get the information. So that's one source of advantage. Other obvious sources of advantage is they have state-of-the-art boxes. There's a whole industry in Silicon Valley devoted to speeding up circuits and switches and the actual boxes themselves. That's an advantage too. It's an advantage they pay for. And they also have, built special networks, fiber optic networks, mm-hmm. and microwave networks inside of New Jersey and between New Jersey and Chicago and between New York and London and so on and so forth. So they have faster paths to send information than most of the people in the marketplace. But the thing that is most disturbing is that the exchange actually sells them the right to be inside the exchange mm-hmm. and get the information faster. The last source of it's probably not the last source of advantage, but another big advantage is that over the last 6 or 7 years, they have persuaded the exchanges to allow them to interact with the market in all kinds of complicated ways that ordinary investors can't. I mean, you submit an order to buy or sell a stock through Schwab or E-Trade or TD Ameritrade. You can say you want to buy it at the market, which means you buy it at whatever the price of the market is. Or you can say, I'll put a limit on what I'm willing to pay. There's some simple rules you can attach to your order.
Good.
There are hundreds of these things for high-frequency traders, and most of them are designed not to execute high-frequency traders' trades, but to extract information from other investors in the marketplace, where they'll, for example, say, I'll only trade with an order that's smaller than me. So they can tease out how big the orders are on the other side. It's all information gathering, which is giving them an unfair advantage. One last thing. I hate to go
no,
on.
No, it's fine. It's fine. I'm getting it.
But one can go on, is right. They have – bought in several cases, bought special access to news that will move financial markets.
Oh.
So they actually have faster access to the information that's going to move prices. And the exchanges, interestingly, not just in the stock market, but in commodities markets especially, have weirdly collaborated with this by, for example, moving the announcement of important news to trading hours, to inside trading hours, so that the market's actually open when the news is released. So it's sort of like,
my goodness.
If you want to really think about it in a broad way, the broad picture is it's like the system figuring out how to create advantages for one player in the system
right. So
they can exploit the general marketplace and then share whatever their winnings are with the people inside the system.
Right.
How it feels.
Wow. And you have to be inside the system. So enter, and only you are able to find these characters. I don't know how to find these people. But you find this, Canadian who's an upstanding human being because he's from Canada where everybody's nice and good, right? And Brad Katsuyama, who works for the Royal Bank of Canada, and he's trying to do his job in the right way, and he finds that he can't do it, so he's trying to uncover the truth. But I'm thinking there have to be other people who are on the outside of this who are also trying to figure out what the heck is going on.
Well, he tells them, and this was one of the things that really intrigued me. Brad Katsuyama is the head of stock market trading at the Royal Bank of Canada in 2007, 2008. All of a sudden, he notices that his orders as his attempt to buy and sell in any given stock is being, you know, to put it nicely, anticipated by someone in the marketplace. That all of a sudden it's like people – there's someone who knows what he wants to do before he does it and gets in front of him, does it and sells like whatever he's trying to buy back to him at a higher price than he would have paid. And the story – this story I've told is basically a detective story of Brad Katsuyama trying to figure out how this stock market works, this automated stock market. And once he – the interesting decision he makes – once he figures out how the game is played, how the market's rigged, he doesn't decide to go and join the rigging. He instead tries to go and fix the marketplace, which is just – for him, it was just a normal impulse. But it isn't everybody's impulse.
Right, right.
He attracts to him all kinds of other people who have the same sort of impulse.
Yeah, I know. And what a cast of characters. We'll find out who they are and continue our conversation with Michael Lewis. Michael Lewis is our guest. His book is, and has been for weeks now, way at the top of the New York Times bestseller list, Flash Boys, A Wall Street Revolt is the name of it. You're familiar with a lot of Michael's work. He did Moneyball, and it became a film. I understand that there are already negotiations for a film based on Flash Boys. He wrote The Blind Side, The Big Short, Liar's Poker, and has been with us before talking about some of his other books. Here's how you reach us. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Hour two of our program today, we're going to be talking about Studs Terkel. There are certain people I will talk about as long as I'm alive, and one of them is Studs Terkel, and tomorrow would have been his 102nd birthday. And there's a big there was last weekend a big festival in Chicago that brought together scholars and musicians and all of the people Studs reached and touched in his life to carry on his legacy. WFMT is, is this going to be valuable? Putting together an archive of all the interviews that Studs ever did. So we're talking 9,000 hours, which really is a record of not only the big shots, the high rollers of the 20th century, but the average person as well. So we'll talk about Studs with a man who is taught working to high school students and got to know Studs when he was in high school back in 1963. Should be good. All right, phone calls for Michael in a moment, and we'll learn more about this incredible cast of characters trying to reform Wall Street in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Michael Lewis is our guest this hour. His latest book, a huge bestseller, and has resulted in investigations already into these kinds of practices. We'll talk to him about that as we continue. The book is Flash Boys, A Wall Street Revolt. 800-486-8655 is the number. Phil is our first caller from Hebron, Illinois. Hi, Phil.
Good afternoon, you guys. Michael, I finished the book a couple weeks ago. Regrettably, I think you're at The Big Short takes number two to this one. This is an even better book. They're both excellent. I got a question for you and a quick comment, and I want to see if you know anything about the comment. Talked to a financial advisor who's pretty high up in the chain with a large insurance company last Thursday, and he told me there had been an investor conference that Warren Buffett was at Berkshire Hathaway, who's kind of renowned for, you know, his returns on investment. He was asked about Berkshire's use of dark pools and high-frequency trading. He did not answer the question. I want to know what you think of that, and I want to know if you will tell the story about the box and the simple solution to slowing everybody down. I work with my hands all day, and I thought that was real ingenious how they decided to slow everybody down.
Great questions. So the first point, I don't think Buffett and his partner Charlie Munger have actually been all that reticent on the subject of high-frequency trading. They were on, I think right after their conference, they went on a television show and were asked about it. And I think Munger said he thought high-frequency traders were like rats in the granary and that they should be removed. And Buffett said that this whole system added absolutely no value. I think he also said it was a matter of some indifference to him personally, but that it was not clearly nonsense. The solution, the box that slows everybody down. this is the my main character and his cast of his band of brothers who leave their jobs on Wall Street to create a stock exchange called IEX, the Investors Exchange. And the idea is that you create a place where high-frequency traders can't prey on investors. You eliminate the predatory activity. And the way they did it is actually it's sort of simple. They have coiled in a box 60 or so kilometers of fiber through which the high-frequency traders' trades must pass in order to get to their exchange. It slows the signals from high-frequency traders' trading machines to their stock exchange down by a few hundred microseconds. It's tiny. It's trivial. But it's enough to eliminate the speed advantage that the high-frequency traders have. So effectively what you're doing, they're saying, we can't control what these high-frequency traders know. We can't control the fact that they know prices at all the other stock exchanges ahead of everyone else. But we can control their ability to act on that. So that's what they do. And they take, in addition, what they do is they take responsibility for the investor's order and they move the investor's order as fast as a high-frequency trader would to the other exchanges. So what they're trying to do is just create a level playing field and eliminate the predatory activity. What's ingenious about it is they're not saying all high-frequency trading is bad. They're not even saying speed is bad. They're just saying we're going to eliminate the predatory activity and we'll see what's left. And if there's useful high-frequency trading to be done on our exchange, we'll welcome it. They have found, however, that most high-frequency traders can't figure out what to do on their exchange.
Thank you so much for your call, Phil. Why is it that everybody would go what must be a fair outlay of money to get all these wires installed to have an advantage on other people? Are we talking about they're making billions more? Is it greed? Is it money that motivates them? Why can't there be a level playing field? Everybody makes a decent living, right?
You sound very Midwestern.
Oh, I am, Michael.
you sound like a voice of moderation in a sea of immoderation. I think that's not how Wall Street people think. Everybody makes a good enough living.
Right.
Just generally, if you're just happy with a good enough living, you tend not to end up on Wall Street. But you're asking an interesting question. You're sort of saying what's the point of view of the people who are exploiting the system? And I think that it's complicated. I think partly it's what they're doing is so complicated that the individual people who are programming for high-frequency trading firms are probably not fully aware of how what they do fits into the larger system.
Goodness.
So a number of the people who are doing it are somewhat oblivious. They're technologists who are very narrow. Now, of course, not everybody is. How do they think about it? They think about it. How do the people who really have more or less perfect knowledge of what's going on in the system and that it is essentially exploitative, how do they think about it? Well, they think about it that look, it's a stupid system. The SEC created it. It's all within the bounds of the law. You hear that phrase a lot. Nothing we're doing is outside the bounds of the law.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can make money doing it, we're the smart guys. We're exploiting holes in the system. To me, my way of thinking, it's disturbing that smart people, when they see a hole in the system, don't just raise their hand and say, we need to fix the system. But they don't. They don't because the sums of money involved are huge.
Mm.
Now, they may not be huge in the context of the multi-trillion-dollar stock market, but we're still talking about probably tens of billions of dollars a year. And we're talking about individual high-frequency traders who, for example, make $90 million in 1 year and are disappointed with how much they make, so they quit their firms to create another firm. So we're talking about vast sums of money involved. People are becoming billionaires doing this. So I think, you can call it greed. Greed has always been, for me, a kind of unsatisfying word. I think of it as status seeking. It's just like ambition. The way you measure yourself on Wall Street is by how much money you make. That's how you keep score. And so these are people who are very, very competitive, built to win, just trying to win.
Mm. Sarah sends an email. Should a regular person, Michael, with a bit of discretionary income, retirement savings, still be in the stock market? Can Michael suggest any way to invest more safely?
So my feeling, the answer to that question is yes. That what's been the rigging in the stock market is this systematic scalp that goes on, and that for an individual investor, it is the actual cost to them is trivial. The social cost is big. The cost of having an unstable stock market that's built for the benefit of the high frequency traders, where you have flash crashes and outages at exchanges and IPOs that don't work. The costs for the society are not trivial, but for the individual investor, I can go to sleep at night knowing that things are basically – they're not going to get ripped off too much, mm-hmm. and that they really probably should be in the – you know, allocate some portion of their savings to the stock market. What can they do? That's a better question, because what we have here is what in economics is known as the problem of the commons. It's in no one's interest sufficiently to stick their neck out to try to fix a system, because the costs are the benefits of a good system and the costs of a bad system are too widespread. And I think if you are so motivated, what you can do is you can ask your online broker, for example, if you can control how your stock market orders are routed. There's now a fair exchange. It's called IEX. They could route your orders to that exchange, and you could be outside the grips of high-frequency traders. And interestingly, I got no stake in any of this. I'm just watching. So I'm not plugging companies because I am an interest in them.
Right.
But there's a company called, and I don't really know them, but it's called Interactive Brokers. And this company is it's an online brokerage firm like Schwab or E-Trade or TD Ameritrade, and they are now advertising. We will send your orders onto IEX to avoid this. We are not selling your orders to high-frequency traders to exploit. So you can pressure, you can create consumer pressure on the people who handle your stock market orders, and you will be doing you'll be doing a little bit of good in the world if you do that.
Yeah. And Michael, you don't need to be modest here, but I would imagine that a lot of that is due to your investigation, isn't it?
So I'm really not being modest when I say that. I'm just trying to be truthful with you here.
Right.
That it wasn't me who set out, who saw a problem, stuck my neck out, risked my career, gave away millions of dollars a year to try to fix the problem. I just wrote about it.
Right, but who would know about it if you didn't write about it?
Well, it's true, but, you know, I saw a great story, and I'll sell a lot of books, and it's all going to work out very nicely for me. I am happy that the process of writing that writing books can have a positive effect on the world if you do it right.
Mm-hmm.
But the incredible characters here are Brad Katsuyama, Ronan Ryan, Rob Park, these guys who left their jobs and risked their careers to try to fix a broken system, because they saw that if you fix the stock market, and you actually could with market pressure, they actually might win. I think they have a shot. If you fix a stock market, you end up possibly reforming the entire financial system, because the stock market is a model for a lot of other markets.
Good grief.
The effect of this is potentially vast.
Yeah.
So I think that so the book has triggered the discussion,
mm-hmm.
but there was no book to write if these guys didn't do what they did.
Gotcha. Well, let's talk about some of the other cast of characters. Mr. Dublin, Mr. Ronan Ryan.
All of them were interesting because all of them were curiously motivated. They were all willing to walk away from what they thought they'd wanted in life. And Ronan Ryan was so curious and a lot of the characters you'll notice are immigrants.
Uh-huh.
A lot of them are not American. So Ronan comes over from Ireland with his father, who gets posted by the Irish government to New York when Ronan is a teenager. His father wants him to see basically how rich Americans live. And so, you know, basically spends all the family savings to rent a place in Greenwich, Connecticut,
and sends
Ronan to school with basically the children of hedge fund managers. And Ronan, of course, any child, he's basically a poor Irish kid, sees this. He thinks the only thing you can do in life, his only sole purpose on earth became get a job on Wall Street. And he goes to these extraordinary lengths to try to get a foot in the door. And as he says, it's not actually all that easy to get a job on Wall Street if you don't know anybody. And he doesn't really have the social connections, and he's not able to do it coming out of school. He ends up working, because he can't find any other job, at MCI, the telecom company. And what he doesn't appreciate is that making himself, as he does, an expert in the U.S. telecommunications system, where the fiber is laid, how to move signals through fiber faster, and so on, he's putting on a collision course with Wall Street, what is going to be Wall Street's most profitable business, which is high-frequency trading.
Yes.
And he becomes they call him high-frequency trading in a box. He becomes the guy that a high-frequency trading firm calls to make their system faster. But still, no one will give him a job. And he spends a decade becoming the world's authority on how to create speed for financial people without ever being able to get on Wall Street until Brad Katsuyama, needing to know how the fiber is laid, needing someone essentially to emerge from a manhole in New Jersey and tell him what's underground, gets Ronan in and says, look, I will give you a job on our trading floor, but you're going to have to explain to me how all this works. I'll explain to you how finance works. You explain to me how fiber optics works. And Ronan's so excited. All of a sudden, he's I'm here. I've arrived. It takes him 3 months to figure out that it's all nonsense. And he couldn't believe how much ignorance there was, how little there was to it, the financial world, how many big shot financial people didn't actually understand how their markets worked. He was awed by his lack of awe. And after about a year, he's willing to just completely walk away from it.
Remarkable. So it takes people who are really, really smart to uncover this, right? And who are kind of, I mean, I love geeks, but so they're geeky in the best sense of the word.
Is there a best sense of the word?
Yes, there is.
I agree. They're geeky. They're geek heroes. That's what they are.
They're geek heroes. That's great.
They're geeks. They're geek superheroes.
Right.
And they're smart. But I tell you what, if you were sitting in their offices, you would not feel the way you do feel sometimes with people who are stupid smart. That you wouldn't feel they're trying to buffalo you with their intellect, that they're trying to bewilder you with complexity. They're good at figuring out – they worry the problem. They're the kind of people who just want to understand it. And they had a great capacity among them to understand it and reduce their understanding to a simple explanation that investors could understand, which is why – When Brad Katsuyama in circa 2010, 2011, when he started to figure some of the rigging out, walks into the offices of some of the most famous hedge fund managers or big mutual fund managers, he's telling them, he's describing to them to the a marketplace that they themselves don't understand in terms they can understand. They're smart, but they have – actually – someone said to me, if you want to understand Brad, he is an explainer. He's an explainer of things. But he doesn't want to be understood. It's not like it's about him. He wants to make you understand.
Right.
And so that is a real difference in that. Mm-hmm. So he's not about – they don't want to seem smart. Mm-hmm. They want you to feel smart.
Yeah, there is a difference. You know, another thing that amazes me is that Wall Street was under some scrutiny, one would have believed, after the whole crash of 2008. And you would have thought that they would make sure that everything was done above board, that this whole system, high-frequency trading that everybody wasn't in on, that somebody would have thought, or a lot of people would have thought, boy, we better not proceed with this. We're under scrutiny.
Well, it's a really good point. I wonder this myself. Here's how I explain that to myself. The first is the financial crisis took place in the bond markets, right? It was about subprime mortgage lending being bundled into bonds, which were then bundled into complicated collateralized debt obligations, and the risk of the loans were thus disguised by really complicated, essentially bond market innovation. This is the stock market, and the stock market and the bond market don't speak a lot. It's a separate part of Wall Street. So that's one thing you have to keep in mind. Secondly, because of the Federal Reserve's monetary policy, very stimulative, you know, basically zero interest rate policy and buying bonds everywhere, they've helped to contrive to elevate the stock market. We've lived through this great rising stock market, and a big bull market in stocks is a really good disguise for a scalping operation. I mean, if the people don't care that pennies are being taken away from them when they're making dollars because the whole market's going up. So I think that contributed to the sort of willingness to the ability to feel not scrutinized. And then finally, I don't think anything that's going on – I take this back. I don't know this, but I think that the people involved are pretty sure. The high-frequency traders, the stock exchanges, the brokerage firms who are part of the system, I think there's some meaningful number of the players who don't think anything's the matter, that they actually – they don't think that – their lawyers tell them all this is within the bounds of regulation. So even if you get caught, you're not breaking the law. So they didn't care – and that's what they cared about. They didn't care how it appeared. They cared, could I be put in jail? And I don't think they can be put in jail. I could be wrong about that.
So what about the guy? What about the guy who was arrested by the FBI who used to work at Goldman? Why was he arrested?
Because when he took – he didn't take things from you. He took things from Goldman Sachs.
Ah. Of course.
Yes, of course. So this is how I got interested in this story in the first place. I read before – no one has ever uttered the phrase to my mind, high-frequency trading, until this Russian computer programmer, high-frequency trading programmer at Goldman Sachs, Serge Alenikov, quits his job, goes to work for a high-frequency trading firm, and 2 days after he leaves Goldman Sachs is arrested by the FBI for stealing Goldman Sachs' high-frequency trading code. And the FBI clearly doesn't know what high-frequency trading code is. They take Goldman Sachs' word on the value of it and all the rest. What drew my attention to it was when he's arrested, the prosecutors say he shouldn't be allowed bail. He shouldn't be let out on the streets because he's a menace to society because he has this code somewhere. And this code, this high-frequency trading code, can be used to manipulate markets on a global scale. And I thought, oh, my God, what is this? I mean, how come I've never heard of this? And why is it okay for Goldman Sachs to have this code, much less this guy on the streets, this Russian programmer on the streets? So that's what got me down this – kind of heading down this path. I had to understand what it was, and that led me to the story and the main characters in the book who could explain it.
Yeah, that's why you're a best-selling author here. Michael Lewis is our guest this hour. His latest book is what we're talking about, and he's given you the gist of what it's all about. He has a real knack for taking – I mean, I don't understand money very well. I'll be upfront about that. It's just not – it's not my forte. It hasn't guided my life in many ways. So when Michael takes this on, I'm thinking, oh, I'm not going to understand this. But he takes what could appear to be a very complicated story with huge ramifications – and tells it through the eyes of people who are trying to change a system, who are good people, who are interesting characters, and thus you get, as you have heard him explain during this hour, a fascinating story and an important story as well. At any rate, that's why it's been on the bestseller list and way up there for weeks now. The book is Flash Boys, A Wall Street Revolt, and Michael Lewis is no stranger to bestsellers. He's the author of Liar's Poker, Moneyball, The Blind Side, and The Big Short. And we're welcoming phone calls for him if you would like to join our conversation. Feel free to do so. We'd like to hear from you. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter if you'd like to use that. At K. Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Michael Lewis is our guest this hour. His book is Flash Boys, A Wall Street Revolt. And we go to Scott in La Crosse next. Hello, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
And hi, Scott.
Michael, it's nice to be able to talk to you again. I think I talked to you about Moneyball once upon a time.
Great.
But what I'd like to expand this a little bit to, right, this conversation to right now, if it's okay by you, Kathleen. My late mother always maintained that what the real harm that was being done by Wall Street was to America's corporations, and by that she meant that everybody is so focused on the next quarter, beating the expectations, and you know how well you're doing now, how well you're doing now, that these CEOs get in there, and all they're caring about is getting the sales up, getting the money out, getting their next good bump. And a lot of them are just, as I understand it, leapfrogging from corporation to corporation, going on to a bigger pond and a bigger pond. Meanwhile, what they're not doing is investing in R&D and new product lines that might take a while to develop. And so if they're all playing this on such a rigged playing field, how is this impacting the corporate expectations of Wall Street?
So I guess the first thing I'd say is his mother has a point. I mean, you know, it is really interesting to see how when you look at any industry, if some of the companies in the industry are public corporations that are answering to shareholders and the demands of short-term returns, and some of the companies are private, how often the private companies seem like they're much better and more steadier and more managed for the long run. It's a great question. It's like, is the stock market as it currently behaves actually like helping the American economy, or is it in some ways doing some damage by creating this incredible myopia, which of course is echoed in the behavior of Wall Street? I mean, Wall Street itself is all about the year-end bonus, all about short-term returns. And when any Wall Street CEO, who's of course a CEO of a public corporation, asks himself, should I be engaged in this high-frequency trading that is actually seems a little dodgy and maybe making the markets less stable, he has to ask himself, you know, can I afford to alienate my shareholders by taking some short-term loss for the long-term benefit of reforming the markets in which I live? And a lot of them don't have the nerve to do that. And that's a big, big problem. Mm. How is this system that I describe affecting corporate America? Well, you know, if you talk to people at Facebook, for example, they might fill your ears about why on earth their initial public offering and their stock was such a, you know, calamity. You know, it was all technical outages that caused the problems. And for their point of view, their lives would be much better and their company would be better off if it had not been subjected to this system. I think that you find there are plenty of people who now they're given an option by Brad Katsuyama of listing their corporate stock on an exchange where there isn't predatory activity taking place in the stock will opt for that. I think that to the extent they understand how the stock market works, it's offensive to have your stock be the stock of your company be used as a tool for a handful of insiders to exploit the rest of the public. So it's only one of, you know, you're touching on big issues and I'm not addressing all those issues, but that's kind of a first pass at an answer.
Yeah, and a good one and a terrific question as always. Thanks, Scott, very much for your call. Our number, we have time for a few more calls, 800-486-8655. So how are Brad and his fellow do-gooders doing with IEX? Is it okay? Is it going to be okay?
I preface this by saying you have to understand that lots of new stock exchanges have been created in the last decade. And the typical pattern is they start very, very slow. Sometimes like they look like they're dead on arrival, like no trading at all going on. When you compare them as they should be compared to the creation of any new stock market, they've been unbelievably successful. So they're trading about, I don't know, 70 million shares a day now. They're already profitable. And they're having venture capital thrown at them left and right to expand. Mm. And resumes from people all over the place who want to come work for them. Mm. So it's a commercial success right now. The question is, can they go from being a pretty trivial slice of the market to being the market? And so right now they're less than 1% of the entire stock market. I mean, but they're 50-something places where stocks are separate little markets. And the biggest player has, you know, 15 or 20% of the market, the New York Stock Exchange. I think there is a path to them becoming the biggest player in the market.
Really?
Yes. And I tell you why I think that. The New York Stock Exchange, before the book came out, tried to buy them. The new owners of the New York Stock Exchange, it was just acquired by a company called ICE. And the new owners walked in and I think they saw this is an unsustainable system. We don't want to be in this business of like selling out the investment public to a handful of traders. And they approached IX and said, come move in here. And Brad Katsuyama's response was basically, I think, I can't move in there because if we do, the minute I'm in there, people won't trust us anymore. And all we have is trust. Huh. We're trying to reestablish trust. And as long as you have those high-frequency traders in your building with privileged access, no one will believe we're providing a level playing field. And, you know, it's – however, now they've gotten more attention and people are thinking about it and scrutinizing it. I can imagine a situation where a New York Stock Exchange says, we're getting out of this unfair business altogether. We're going to become the fair exchange. We'll buy you for even more money, and you'll become the New York Stock Exchange. That's not an outlandish possibility. So I think that they're on a path that everything's working out better than planned so far. Hmm. But God knows what's going to happen.
Maybe early retirement in Vancouver, huh? You never know. Scott in Wrightstown. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call,
sure.
Kathleen. Michael, back in the mid-1980s, I was in the math department in Ohio, Bowling Green State University, and one of the researchers there had been a trader on the floor in one of the markets in Chicago, and he was telling me about the mathematical programs he was working out at that time, and he said he had a real advantage because he knew the math, and he had been on the floor. It sounded very much like what you're talking about now. Has this been around for 30 years or more?
Not in this form. A trader who was – so I was actually there in the 80s. I actually spent some time on the floor – on the Chicago exchanges, the floor of the exchanges in the 80s. I was in the Solomon – I was a derivatives person at Solomon Brothers. And – even if you had someone, as we did, who had an informational advantage, intellectual advantage, because they had superior ways to, say, value a financial option, they didn't have a speed advantage because they certainly didn't have that kind of speed advantage because everything still went through people. What's happened now is that speed has become, for some traders, the only advantage. It isn't a superior mathematical model. It's not a superior analysis of a security. It's simply being able to get the prices of stocks before everybody knows them. Any price change, if you know it before everybody else, you've got an edge, which is not a – I mean, it's an informational edge, but it's different from a – bringing insight into the marketplace. It's simply getting the purest form of inside information, which is where prices are going before everybody else. And that has really only been going on in a big way for the last 5 or 6, 7 years, since 2007.
Hmm.
Okay. And it's mainly because of the fiber optic, those technologies.
So it's mainly because – the book explains this, but it's mainly because the SEC passed some regulation that enabled it, that enabled – that sort of created an artificially slow information feed to the investment public that they traded on. So the prices that you are greeted with when you go to interact with the market are stale prices, at the same time allowing – people to move inside the exchanges, high-frequency traders, private actors, to move inside the exchanges and create faster pictures of the marketplace so they know the market before the investment public.
Yeah.
And that gap, and it's a speed gap of a few milliseconds, but
goodness,
it's worth billions, has only existed since 2007, since the regulation was passed that enabled it.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Scott, for the call. Michael, you've done it again. Thank you so much for being with us, and what a fascinating hour. I get it now. I talk to you and I get it. I don't know anything about this, so you helped me. Thank you. It was great.
I got lucky. Thank you.
Thank you. Michael Lewis, the book is Flash Boys, A Wall Street Revolt. It's our understanding that its movie consideration is also already being discussed. He's the author of Moneyball, made into a great movie, The Blind Side, made into a great movie, The Big Short, and Liar's Poker. And this book has just recently been published. It's on the New York Times bestseller list, among the top five. Published by Norton. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this fascinating show and to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee where the sun is out.